Welcome to Jurisdictions, an Asset Institute podcast. My name is Carl Lewis, and I'll be your host. In this episode, we focus on the ongoing proceedings initiated by South Africa against Israel at the International Court of Justice on the 29th of December, 2023. It did so in light of, and I quote, acts threatened, adopted, condoned, taken, and being taken by the government and military of the State of Israel against the Palestinian people, a distinct national, racial, and ethnical group, in the wake of the attacks in Israel on the 7th of October, 2023. End of quote. South Africa is claiming that Israel ought to be found in violation of its obligations under the Genocide Convention, for failing to prevent, as well as committing, genocide. A mere 6 months have passed since the October 7 attacks. To paraphrase the court, these were committed by Hamas and other armed groups present in the Gaza Strip. The attacks involved the killing of more than 1,200 persons, the injuring of thousands, and the abduction of some 240 people, many of which, according to recent reports, are still unaccounted for. In the past 6 months, reports indicate that Israel's large-scale military operation in Gaza has resulted in the Palestinian death toll now surpassing over 33,000. Gaza has been devastated. Horrific scenes of what Palestinians in Gaza have and continue to endure fill the news. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization has recently reported that half of the population in Gaza faces an imminent man-made famine between now and May 2024. Many feel disenchanted by the lack of urgent mobilization of the international community, and many feel disenchanted by the international legal order. Hope may have been raised by the ICJ's recent order of provisional measures on the 20th of March, which called on Israel to take all necessary and effective measures to ensure, amongst other things, urgently needed humanitarian assistance for all concerned. But these are not the first provisional measures to be ordered by the court in this case. It is in this context that I am joined by four experts in international law who provide us with various legal, political, and critical considerations to keep in mind when considering the implications of the South Africa v. Israel proceedings and the provisional measures ordered by the court so far. What are provisional measures and obligations in the common interest? What implications follow from these proceedings beyond the Peace Palace? And in what sense has it been argued that the ICJ may be denying reality? All of this and more will be discussed, as in the previous episode, through a narrative format. And so it is important to point out that each guest on this episode was recorded separately and before the ICJ's latest order of provisional measures on the 28th of March. The views expressed by the participants in this podcast are therefore not to be taken as necessarily linked to the content of the other guests. The views in this podcast are also made in the speakers' individual capacity and do not reflect the positions of the respective organisations, partners, or anyone else for that matter. To start us off, we are joined by Dr. Giulia Pinzauti, Assistant Professor of International Law at Leiden University and former Associate Legal Officer at the International Court of Justice between 2015 and 2016. Giulia, what more could you tell us about this case?
So this case concerns Israel's alleged responsibility for committing genocide against Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and for failing to prevent genocide. So in its application, South Africa argues that Israel's conduct is in breach of the Genocide Convention. Genocide is a very serious international crime. This convention, in a nutshell, prohibits a number of acts that are carried out with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a protected group. This is what we call the intent to commit genocide. And South Africa argues that Israel is killing Palestinians in Gaza in large numbers, is causing them serious bodily and mental harm. It's imposing measures that are intended to prevent Palestinian births and inflicting conditions of life that in the long term are calculated to bring about the destruction of Palestinians as a group. This is to do with the imposition of a total siege on Gaza, including the cutting of water, electricity, fuel, and the restrictions to the delivery of humanitarian aid, which is vital for the Palestinian population in Gaza. We have to remember that there's already a 16-year-long blockade on Gaza. And finally, South Africa argues that Israel didn't hold serious Israeli officials and others accountable or their direct and public incitement to commit genocide. And this has to do with the use of dehumanizing language towards the Palestinian people in Gaza. Now, how did this case get before the ICJ, and what does South Africa have to do with the alleged commission of genocide by Israel against the Palestinians? Both Israel and South Africa are state parties to the Genocide Convention. And this convention, in its Article 9, provides that disputes, disagreements concerning the interpretation or application of the convention can be referred to the International Court of Justice. And it's on this basis that South Africa instituted proceedings against Israel. The court's case law establishes that all the states that are parties to the Genocide Convention have a legal interest in ensuring that the convention is complied with, and they have standing to invoke the responsibility of another state party, even if they're not specifically affected.
International lawyers will be familiar with terms such as standing and legal interest, but this may not be so clear for members of the public, even less so when followed by Latin terms, like when South Africa in its application claimed that it seeks, and I quote, to protect the erga omnes partes rights it has under the Genocide Convention, as well as the erga omnes obligations it has to prevent genocide, end of quote. To briefly explain these terms, we're also joined by Dr. Sarah Thin, Assistant Professor in International and European Law at Radboud University.
Under international law, there are a variety of different things you need in order to bring a case. Well, one of them is what we call standing, so a right to bring a case or to invoke the responsibility of a state before an international court. And normally or traditionally in international law, only injured states were able to do that. So only if the breach of an obligation directly impacted another state would that other state be able to invoke the responsibility of the first state. But increasingly in international law, we have recognition that that's not always how things work. And obligations erga omnes is a concept that's almost a public law concept within international law, where obligations erga omnes is just a Latin term for owed to everyone. So it's an obligation that's owed by one state to all other states, which essentially means that if a state breaches that obligation, it affects all other states. And all other states would have a right to bring a right of standing, so a right to bring a case against the breaching state. And then we always have a kind of little sister or little brother concept, which is obligations erga omnes partes. So rather than it being an obligation owed to all states, it's an obligation in a treaty that's owed to all parties to that treaty, because the treaty itself is set up to protect a common interest of all the parties. So that all said, South Africa has brought this case based on the Genocide Convention, which is a treaty that is set up to protect a common interest, so the common interest in preventing genocide. So South Africa has standing on the basis that the prohibition of genocide is an obligation erga omnes partes within the Genocide Convention. So even though it isn't an injured state, it's an uninjured state, it can still bring a case on the basis of this erga omnes partes concept.
However, Dr. Thin rightly reminds us that standing is not the only procedural issue that we need to pay attention to when it comes to states bringing a case to the International Court of Justice.
So we've talked about the role that erga omnes obligations play in standing, but standing isn't the only thing you need to bring a case. So you need to still comply with admissibility rules and rules for jurisdiction. The ICJ is based on what we call the principle of consent. So in order for a case to be brought against a state in the ICJ, that state needs to have consented to the ICJ's jurisdiction. So it needs to have given permission for the ICJ to make a judgment on it. The two most common ways that that can happen is what we call an Article 36 declaration, or the acceptance of the ICJ's compulsory jurisdiction, which is when states make a declaration saying, I, as a state, accept that the ICJ can hear cases involving my state. Generally, sometimes there are limitations made, but you know, generally any cases in the future I give consent to. And the other common way is compromissory clauses. So within the Genocide Convention, for example, Article 9, it says something along the lines of, if there is a dispute over the interpretation or application of this convention, then that dispute can be taken to the ICJ. So when states ratify the convention, then they give consent through this clause.
With these issues of standing and jurisdiction clarified, let us take a look at what South Africa has been asking for in lieu of the ICJ's judgment on the merits of the case.
So South Africa filed its application. It instituted a contentious case against Israel. But this case may take a few years to reach a ruling on the merits. So South Africa, contextually with an application, has asked the court to order provisional measures. These are urgent measures that are needed to protect the rights of the Palestinian people in Gaza from further harm, that are designed to ensure Israel's compliance with the Genocide Convention and also safeguard South Africa's ability to have the case fairly adjudicated pending resolution of the case on the merits. There are five conditions for the court to indicate provisional measures. The first is prima facie jurisdiction. It means that the court's jurisdiction doesn't have to be established convincingly, but only prima facie. There has to be a link between the measures that the applicant requests and the rights of the parties. The claim has to be plausible. A lot has been said about this. What it means is that there is a certain expectation of success on the merits of South Africa's claim. And then there needs to be a risk of irreparable prejudice and urgency of the situation that demands the indication of these urgent measures prior to the resolution of the case on the merits. The measures indicated by the court are binding. So Israel has an obligation to comply with the order.
The International Court of Justice has gone on to deliver two orders of provisional measures in response to South Africa's requests. The latest, on the 20th of March, arrived after the recording of most of this episode. Dr. Julia Pinzati will return at the end of the podcast to consider in a little bit more detail. However, for now, let us return to January. What did the International Court of Justice conclude in its first order of provisional measures?
It ordered six measures. The first two aim, broadly speaking, at preventing genocidal acts. So Israel must take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of genocidal acts and must ensure that its military forces specifically do not commit any genocidal acts. The third measure is directed at preventing and punishing the direct and public incitement to commit genocide. And then the court ordered Israel to take measures to enable the provisions of basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So very important measure. And then it ordered Israel to take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence. This is very important for the case going forward to the merits. And finally, the court ordered Israel to submit a report on the measures taken to comply with its order within 1 month. So a very brief time frame. And we know that then South Africa had an opportunity to comment on the report submitted by Israel, which is still confidential. And because particularly the humanitarian situation on the ground hasn't improved since, subsequently to the first request, South Africa has then submitted another request for the court to issue provisional measures on its own initiative or proprio motu, as we say. And because the court declined to do so, then South Africa filed another request for the modification of the order from the 26th of January to address the starvation of civilians in Gaza.
Taking this into consideration, it's important to think about what implications this order of provisional measures in January carries both within and beyond the legal sphere.
As you said, far-reaching implications that go beyond the legal sphere. It has political implications for Israel. I think it's a reputational blow no state should even get close to the point at which an allegation of genocide becomes plausible. To be clear, the court hasn't established that genocide is being committed in Gaza. It only established that South Africa's claim is plausible, but no state should even get close to that. And I think this ruling is significant for the implications that it has for third states that are not party to the case. As we know, ICJ cases, contentious cases, are only binding for the parties, but there are certain implications for state parties to the Genocide Convention that have undertaken the obligation to prevent genocide. In other cases, the court has said that the obligation to prevent genocide arises when a state learns of, or should normally have learned of, the existence of a serious risk that genocide will be committed. I think with this ruling, we're clearly at this stage. And this means that all state parties have to take measures within their power to prevent the commission of genocide. Now, what that actually means, nobody knows. You know, this is probably one of the most important obligations in the Genocide Convention, because it's an obligation of prevention, and it's 75 years since the adoption of the Genocide Convention, and yet we don't know what states should do or not do in order to prevent genocide. In the Bosnian genocide case, the court said that what states parties must do depends on a number of factors, because they don't all have the same capacity to influence the action of persons or other actors that are likely to commit or already committing genocide. But definitely, I think this order will have a bearing on those states that are supporting Israel politically, diplomatically, financially, and through the provision of weapons, for example. And I think this is how Nicaragua then filed a new case against Germany for its failure to prevent genocide. And I think potentially another implication of this case and the ruling in particular is on proceedings before another Hague-based court, the International Criminal Court. As we know, there is an ongoing investigation into the situation in Palestine that only, I mean, as far as we know, only concerns the alleged commission of war crimes by both parties to the conflict. I think after this ruling and with the events that are currently unfolding, the Office of the Prosecutor to probably include crimes against humanity and genocide within the scope of its investigation into the situation in Palestine.
That the January order carried and continues to carry implications became clear, for example, when Nicaragua made its application to institute proceedings against Germany for alleged breaches of certain international obligations in respect to the occupied Palestinian territory. This became especially clear when it stated that, following the news and the court's order of January, and I quote, Germany cannot deny knowledge of the serious illegality of the conduct of Israel, nor can it deny that its knowledge triggered obligations for Germany under international law to prevent genocide, to not aid and assist or be complicit in genocide, and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and other peremptory norms of international law. End of quote. The South Africa and Nicaragua, amongst others, are seeking to bring and support such claims at the International Court of Justice. It brings to mind a mobilization of the international legal community, even if only in the realm of international dispute settlement. Ego omnes norms, after all, speak of the international community as a whole. But in what sense are we to understand such calls to an international community or community interests? Is this perhaps a call to the public of public international law?
I think the term international community is interesting in international law, partly because it's used in so many different ways by so many people to mean so many different things. And often there are arguments of, you know, who is the international community? Is it all states? Is it more than just states? Is it not necessarily all states, but most states? But I think, as you say, it's better to move away from this question of who precisely makes up this group, but rather to think about international community and international community interest as a form of public and public interest in international law. So we don't usually spend too much time talking about who exactly is the public, because public and publicness and public interest is an idea. So it's an idea to which we impute certain values and certain interests, whether that's prevention of genocide, the prevention of serious human rights violations, the prevention of torture. We say that this is a public interest in and of itself. And I think that community interest serves the same role in the international legal order that public interest does, or a similar, perhaps not exactly the same, but it serves a similar role that public interest does in the domestic legal order. With community interest, I also think that the use of the term depends a bit on the context. So some people use the term community interest in quite a rhetorical fashion, really more about, emotive language than it is about law as such. But then in some contexts, international community interest as a concept has legal relevance or legal effect, particularly in the context of obligations erga omnes, for example, as we talked about, and peremptory norms or norms of jus cogens. So these are kind of examples of ways in which the concept of community interest has real life legal impact rather than just being an idea in international law.
The idea that there are obligations under international law that are owed to all states is quite a powerful one. That it can carry very real legal consequences then raises the stakes. But where did this idea come from?
The idea that there exist or existed certain obligations in international law that were owed to all states existed before this issue came before the court, but it was only ever something that was, in theory, in scholarship, something that academics talked about, but that hadn't seen the light in practice, so to speak. But then we have this case, Barcelona Attraction, which was really more of a case to do with diplomatic protection than any of these big ideas that we normally associate with erga omnes. And the court said, almost as an aside, that there are, unlike the obligations that we're talking about now in this case, diplomatic protection, there are these obligations in international law, obligations erga omnes, which are owed to all states and which would generate a right of standing for all states to invoke responsibility if they are breached. So kind of as an aside, the court recognized these types of obligations in theory, but since then, no successful case has ever been brought. There have been cases that have been brought, like the East Timor case, for example, where states have tried to use this concept in international law. But in East Timor, the main issue was admissibility restrictions. So admissibility and jurisdiction restrictions still apply, even if we're talking about obligations erga omnes. And so since then, there hasn't been a successful case brought on this basis, which can be contrasted against obligations erga omnes partis, which in many ways operates similarly to erga omnes proper, but only within the framework of a particular treaty. And there have been multiple cases brought on the basis of erga omnes partis in environmental law with the Whaling case, multiple different cases based on the Genocide Convention, Torture Convention, and so on and so forth. So the erga omnes partis clearly have played a role, but erga omnes proper, so far, not yet.
One practice that is developing, and that may contribute to this idea of the mobilization of the international community, is that of states intervening in contentious cases. Both Nicaragua and Colombia delivered applications to intervene in the South Africa v. Israel case. And in a recent statement, Ireland's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Defence announced that Ireland too will intervene. What are the rules for states to intervene in cases before the ICJ? And why do they do this?
So, in addition to the parties to a case, other states can intervene, which essentially means that they can take part in the proceedings and can make submissions on different aspects of the case. There are two different bases for intervention, or two different types of intervention. The most popular, the most common one so far, has been under Article 63 of the ICJ statute. States can use this form of intervention when the case involves the application of a particular multilateral treaty, and the state wanting to intervene is also a party to that multilateral treaty. And the idea behind this kind of intervention is that if a multilateral treaty to which they are party is being interpreted, then they should have a say in that interpretation because it could impact the application of that treaty to them later on in a different case. And so that's the idea behind that form of intervention. And as I say, it's been very popular. We have the mass intervention of more than 30 states in the Ukraine versus Russia case. It also 7 states that have requested to intervene in the Myanmar genocide case. Also worth noting that ICJ has recently changed its rules to potentially restrict the oral submissions of states intervening on this basis, partly, I think, in reaction to the fact that so many states are now doing this. It really, before the Ukraine versus Russia case, there were only a handful of interventions in the whole history of the court. And then we suddenly have 30. So it's something that the court needs to come to terms with. But I think states intervene in this way, partly for the reason that it was created, so partly because the multilateral treaty would or could apply to them. But they often intervene on behalf of a particular party, so they're not so much making submissions only on the convention itself, but more on the particular application in the particular case, even if that's not strictly speaking how this type of intervention is supposed to work. It definitely serves a political role. When all of these states are making very similar situations, the legal benefit or the legal added value is not always particularly clear. So I think there is definitely a political side to this intervention. And I think it reflects a mixture of common and individual interests. So states are doing this partly because they see a violation of what they would deem to be a community or a common interest obligation and are taking a stand against that. But their intervention does also serve individual interests of states for sure, on both political and legal levels. To draw a contrast between that and the intervention we see in the South Africa versus Israel case, the intervention or the request to intervene by Nicaragua is not based on Article 63, but on Article 62, which is a different form of intervention and one which has been used far less in the history of the court so far. So Article 62 intervention is based not on the interpretation of a treaty, but on the interest that the intervening state has in the outcome of the case. So this is really limited to situations where, in deciding the case, the court would have to decide on something that would impact the interest of another state. And so it leaves room for a state to intervene to make submissions if it's impacted by the case. And some people would argue, myself and a colleague of mine, Craig Eggett from Maastricht University, have argued that this would cover situations of erga omnes. So where an erga omnes obligation has been violated, that would create an interest on all states or of all states to intervene under Article 62. But until now, that's never been tested. But now we are seeing it being tested by Nicaragua. It's not entirely clear why Nicaragua has chosen this as the legal basis to intervene. Nicaragua is a party to the Genocide Convention, so they could presumably also intervene on the basis of Article 63. But perhaps this is a statement to call this an obligation erga omnes, to be able to use Article 62. Or perhaps it's because Article 63 in theory is supposed to be about the interpretation of a treaty rather than the outcome of a case, whereas Article 62 is supposed to be about the interest that a state has in the outcome of a case rather than just the interpretation of the rule. So that, yeah, that's not particularly clear, but that could be the reason.
So the court has recently moved to restrict the possibility for states to intervene in cases before it. And there are political questions that surround such interventions. But perhaps one of the most talked about aspects of the ICJ's Order of Provisional Measures in January, even though it wouldn't have surprised international lawyers, was the absence of a call for a ceasefire.
One aspect of the case that has been discussed a lot is the fact that the court didn't order a ceasefire or didn't order the suspension of Israel's military operations. And there was a lot of frustration about the court's decision. This was the first measure that had been requested by South Africa. So the first thing that I'd say, because I think it's important to clarify, that the court has the discretion to indicate measures that are different from those requested by the parties, and has often done so in its case law. So there's nothing new about under the sun. The court didn't even discuss South Africa's request for a suspension of Israel's military operations. So we don't know exactly why it was dismissed, but I can take a guess. So my guess is that ordering a ceasefire was not in the cards, because this case is between South Africa and Israel, and the conflict is between Israel and Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups. So only one party to the conflict, only Israel, is a party to the case. And the court could only order measures that are binding on Israel, and couldn't order any measures that would be binding on Hamas, because one, it's a non-state actor, and two, it's not a party to the case. So I think this was very unlikely for the court to do. I wasn't surprised at all when the court issued its decision and didn't order the suspension of Israel's military operation. This is yet another example where we see the power of the court, but also the limits of the court and what it can or it cannot do in a particular situation, and especially when there is an ongoing situation of armed conflict and a very politically charged situation. I think it's a very good thing that the court issued the ruling that it did. It's a victory, I wouldn't say for South Africa, like for one of the parties to the case, but it's a victory for the rule-based international order, because it's a decision that speaks the law and sets a certain narrative of the facts. And for me, those are two very important things, particularly in that context. Then, having said that, it is a fact, and that there is a compliance problem, especially with provisional measures order, not this in particular, but just more generally. You know, just a few months before, the court issued a provisional measure order in the case brought by Ukraine against Russia, where it ordered the suspension of Russia's military operations. And that's yet another example of states not abiding by the court's order. Unfortunately, as I was saying, there are limits to what states can do to enforce ICJ rulings, particularly those on provisional measures. But I still think that they are important.
Let us return now to an issue that was mentioned earlier. That is the provision of arms to Israel. Dr. Leon Castellanos-Yankevich, senior researcher in international law at the TMC Asset Institute, an expert in international law on arms trade and human rights, explains for us what the international law regulating arms trade covers and the importance of the Court's January order, especially in respect to arms trade.
So the international law regulating arms trade is a set of obligations and commitments that states undertake in order to conduct responsible trade in weapons, be they military weapons or weapons that are destined for the civilian market. So countries need to arm their defense capabilities. They need to react to external threats, internal threats, and so on. And that is why they procure military equipment and law enforcement equipment, and they source this from around the world. And there is a set of legal rules which govern the trade in these sensitive products, both when the state is using them, but also when civilians are using them, such as, for example, when you have people who arm themselves for self-defense or use this kind of product in the sporting activities or collections. And so for every kind of use, you have different kinds of rules that apply. But particularly for states, since we're talking about export authorizations in the context of armed conflict, in particular in this program today. For states, the core obligation would be contained in a treaty called the Arms Trade Treaty, which entered into force 10 years ago this year, and which tells states, okay, if you are buying or selling weapons to other states, this is what you have to do. These are the rules that you need to comply with. And essentially, you have a set of reporting obligations in order to make this a little bit more transparent, which because it's a notoriously opaque industry. And you also have risk assessment obligations when it comes to buying these products or selling these products. There are certain due diligence procedures that need to be fulfilled by both parties, right? The buyers and the sellers. And the Arms Trade Treaty lays this down very, very clearly. So the order for provisional measures issued is important because it recognizes that the aftermath of the horrible things that happened on October the 7th present us with a clear risk that there might be genocide happening in the Gaza Strip, or that there is imminence in relation to that risk, right? There is no formal pronouncement from the International Court of Justice that genocide is taking place or has taken place. That's very important to underline. But the court does point to this idea of risk. And for someone working on the arms trade, such as myself, this is very, very important because a lot of the arms trade obligations, including the Arms Trade Treaty that I mentioned earlier, rely on this idea of risk in order to prevent negligent exports and transfers. So states which are dealing with high volumes of arms trade or any kind of arms trade need to conduct a risk assessment before selling or transferring their products to third parties. And this risk assessment typically includes human rights due diligence procedures, where the state needs to determine whether or not there is a plausible reason to be concerned about those weapons being used negligently or criminally in order to harm human rights in the third country, which is buying the weapons. If there is a reasonable risk or a clear risk that this is going to happen, that human rights violations are going to be committed with these weapons, then the export should not take place, or something must be done to mitigate the risk. So going back to the ICJ's decision in the provisional measures issued to the state of Israel, because there is now a risk that the court has identified all states that provide assistance or support in military terms to Israel are on notice that their contribution to those transfers could result in aiding and abetting the commission of genocide, because this risk is present, because there is such a urgent need to reduce the violence, to reduce the way in which the military operations are being conducted and to de-escalate them. That would be sort of the goal that the court is trying to reach, right? To mitigate the situation, to open humanitarian corridors, to facilitate access to people in need so that they can get the help that has not until now been available to them. So, as I said, states are on notice now that this important decision or order for provisional measures has been issued by the ICJ. All other states, I'm sure, have taken this and factored this into their analysis and assessment of whether or not to send weapons to Israel. I'm here talking about military cooperation and military capabilities. I'm not talking about trade in, you know, goods such as foodstuffs or scientific cooperation and other things. It's really just about military. So I think that's the major takeaway for third states, for third entities, including non-state actors, right? So companies could also be exposed to litigation if they are supplying Israel with weapons which could be used in order to carry out the genocidal acts that could potentially happen according to the International Court of Justice.
Think once more about this idea of the mobilization of the international legal community. A landmark decision came out of the Dutch domestic system by the Hague Court of Appeal on the 12th of February 2024, which ordered the Dutch government to stop supplying Israel with F-35 fighter jet parts.
So this is a decision that came down in February in the Dutch courts. Essentially, what the judges have said is that they ordered the Dutch state to stop transferring F-35 parts to the state of Israel, because, again, there was a clear risk that this aircraft is being used to commit violations of the Geneva Conventions, according to the Hague Court of Appeal. First off, it's important to say that this case is separate from the International Court of Justice proceedings. There is no relationship, procedural or other, with the ICJ. There is, of course, overlap in the factual context of both cases, but this is a case that was brought by Dutch NGOs and peace organizations who are concerned with Israel's, according to them, excessive use of force on the Gaza Strip and vis-a-vis the Palestinian people. And they identified this F-35 program, which the Dutch state cooperates with. This is a program that is coordinated by the United States of America and other European states, which assemble and transfer parts of this particular aircraft to other cooperating states, including Israel. So now I believe there is a military sort of facility here in the Netherlands, which enables those transfers. And that is what is now being ordered to stop. The government has stated that they're going to appeal this decision in the Supreme Court of the Netherlands. And in the meantime, they are prevented from continuing the transfers to the state of Israel. For now, what is going to happen is we still need to wait and see what the Supreme Court will say. But let me go back briefly to that decision in February and explain a little bit what the court, how the court reasoned, because that brings us back to this idea of risk. The court there used international and Dutch law, particularly the Arms Trade Treaty, in order to spell out the obligations that the Netherlands has when it comes to transferring weapons and their parts to countries such as Israel. So the court relied on the treaty in order to say that the Netherlands had to conduct a new risk assessment after the beginning of hostilities that started on 7th of October in order to determine whether or not the transfers represented new risks, whether new risks were identified. The Dutch government said no, that a risk assessment had been conducted 5 years ago and that this was enough. And the NGOs disagreed. They thought that, you know, there is new facts on the ground. This conflict is presenting us with fresh challenges and there needs to be a new risk assessment. And that's what the court agreed with. The court said that the Dutch government, by not conducting those risk assessments, the new risk assessments, was in violation of its obligations contained in the Arms Trade Treaty. Interestingly, it also cited a second international agreement, which is the EU common position. That's the European Union legal framework that regulates arms transfers. The EU common position sort of tracks the Arms Trade Treaty in the risk assessment obligation. So there is a set of 8 criteria which states need to take into account before they transfer these weapons. And it's a step-by-step analysis. And this analysis includes, are the weapons going to be used to commit human rights violations? Are they likely to be used to commit international humanitarian law violations? And the Court of Appeal here in The Hague went through this list and analyzed it against the facts on the ground as they've been reported by NGOs such as Amnesty International, but also United Nations Special Rapporteurs. These are experts that are appointed by the UN to determine what are the most urgent sort of needs that need to be highlighted and brought to member states in order to take action and prevent a humanitarian catastrophe. So these reports are very comprehensive. They come from experts who are in the region and on the ground. And so the court relied on these official reports from the UN in order to conclude that, again, because of the gravity of the situation there, that the new risk assessment had to be conducted. So the Dutch government, again, disagrees with this and is appealing the decision. But for now, the F-35 transfers will stop, have been suspended. And I think, you know, opening this up to broader conversations, this strategic litigation model is being used in other countries as well. You see lawsuits in the UK, in Denmark, which have been presented with similar arguments in order to stop arms transfers to Israel. So this is an interesting development and a new way, which I don't think we have really seen, right? A new way of holding states accountable for their participation or contribution to violations of the Geneva Conventions or serious human rights violations, because we usually think about the arms industry as a given, right? As something that is just there and it's sort of immutable and inevitable, because of course states need an army, of course states need to defend themselves, and of course they have the right to exist. And I think that for a long time, this sort of, you know, baseline assumption has sort of isolated the arms industry from scrutiny and I would also argue accountability, as I see in the research that I do. So that is, I think, another reason why these cases are interesting, because they're opening up a new way of bringing actors accountable when it comes to international law compliance, compliance with treaties, and so it's not just about the states, it's also about other stakeholders who are around them.
But there are further critical perspectives to consider when thinking about the international setting and cases being brought before the ICJ holistically. Let us take a step back with Dr. Shahad Hamouri, lecturer in law at the University of Kent, and whose research lies at the intersection of public international law, international economic law, and legal theory, to consider how this case may also be viewed as a denial of reality. For Dr. Hamouri, it is important to consider how, from the perspective of someone who is living in Gaza, or who is not an expert in international law, the January Provisional Measures Order and the South Africa v. Israel case could seem somewhat absurd.
So to begin with, law is a system of signs. And inevitably, when we look at social phenomena, we have to reduce the social phenomena in order to understand it. In our reduction of social phenomena, we choose specific theoretical presumptions in our path towards this reduction of reality. And a way to describe that reality. Of course, how we portray that reality ends up being shaped by what are the theoretical presumptions that we choose to opt for. So there is no way where we expect at any point that the International Court of Justice would be able to reflect upon brute reality as a whole. And yet, what I am saying is actually that the reductivities in this case are so wide, are so atrocious, and in a way that's very normalized to the ordinary spectator. And perhaps what would really help us to imagine what I'm talking about is if we are to look at how the decision looked like from the perception of someone who is living in Gaza at the moment, and to understand and to look at it from the perception of the subject affected by this brute reality. So I'm going to describe this denial of reality on two levels. The first level is, the court at the end of the day, opted for indeterminate language, that when read through through the eyes of an alien to the whole context, actually sound quite illogical. You are asking a state that is currently accused of genocide not to partake in genocidal acts. So you're asking that state to identify what genocidal acts are, and also denying the fact that genocide is systematic, structural, infused, and in this case, infused as a policy of a larger settler colonial project. So the fact that you think that these two things could be separated, you opted for language that is closer to absurd, indeterminate, in a balancing act. A balancing act between the world status quo as it exists, the political liberal status quo, which has created an exceptionalist position for Israel. Most recently, Raz Segal and Daniel Luigi have written a great piece in relation to Israeli exceptionalism, specifically in relation to genocide, and that is completely aligned with the world status quo as we know it. And the court was also balancing with the pressure coming from the Global South. It wanted to avoid another position where it alienates the Global South. To end that balancing act, it opted for indeterminate language. But yet, the question is, how did we reach a place where such a balancing act in the face of such an extreme brutality can happen? And that happens through the theoretical presumptions and the experiences that were internalized into the language of international law, as well as its procedure, as well as the consciousness of the people who partake in the international legal community. By that, I mean, international law never integrated the stories of colonization or the lessons learned from colonization. If it had done so, it would have easily been capable of recognizing that when I have a siege of over 17 years of a dominated population that is deprived of basic premises of human rights, that I am in a context that is very apt for ethnic cleansing and genocide. It would have recognized the historic lessons learned again and again. It would have recognized the collective memory of anyone who has looked at archival evidence or read histories of colonization, that the picture in Gaza right now is an exact picture of genocidal settler colonial violence. The amputations, the starvation, complete subjugation, the humiliation, the detention, everything about it. And this has been going on for 75 years. And yet, international law is not able to recognize this. It's not able to see that reality. Actually, its indeterminate language facilitated the path where we are still going to the International Court of Justice to ask, is this occupation legal or illegal? It is using outdated language that, as Frederic Maigret says, if it remains this way, it will at some point lose complete relevance to the world. And why? It's very easy to say why. It's why is because economically advanced states whose economic interest is directly invested in the proliferation of armed conflict all around the world have worked throughout the years to ensure through their own lawmaking power that such development doesn't happen in the law. And there's a lot of people who have written about this. So in this sense, we are looking at something as brutal as people having to carry the body parts of their children in bags through a language that is not only outdated, misplaced, but also that is apologetic to affinities of a history that hasn't reconciled itself with colonization. And it's very clear when we see that even with the reactions to the case, when Germany stood to the stage and said that I will be making a submission in support of Israel in this case, and Namibia then reminded them that, well, you are a serial perpetrator of genocide, and reminding us of the story of the Herero people. And in reality, if you walk around Germany, if you walk around the mainstream liberal person in higher education in Germany, discussion of the Herero people would be almost non-existent. And again, my own reflections about this come from my own lived experience, having been a person whose life was indirectly shaped by war economies across the region. I come from a region that where war is completely proliferated on every single level, and not only that, with generational trauma, having lived that across generations, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, all of my ancestry, as well as, of course, the Syrian war, the Iraqi war, the Lebanese war, and the Palestinian war. So we say, mashallah, it's the proliferation everywhere. And when I first came to Europe, the value of the words that I was saying was directly stripped from them, as if I was directly identified as an angry Arab woman who is describing things that are quite irrelevant, directly denying the causality between A and B. What I'm trying to describe here is that the affinities of the liberal spectator to which the whole spectacle of the International Court of Justice speaks might be naturally blind towards articulating the brutality of which we speak. And it is because of this formula that the normalization of that ethos, the fact that we all took these proceedings seriously and these legal discussions quite very seriously in our capacity to identify the violence at hand, or at the end of the day, opt for a language that has literally done nothing to protect the people ever since it was shown. This tells us that when reality is being described through the lens of international law, it is desensitized from brutality. It is told through a lens that overlooks systematicity as well as long duration in time. It avoids that, and actually, in the course of some work that I did in relation to submissions to the International Court of Justice, it was very difficult to actually include the words systematic, structural, as well as the language used by states of the Global South in the 1960s and 70s, from the Declaration on Ending Colonization and the Declaration on Friendly Relations. These are all words and instruments that could be used to articulate how domination works. And these words are given much less value. They're ostracized in the halls of the International Court of Justice. They're looked down upon in the sense of not being positivist enough, not being strong enough for such argumentation. And sadly, that was my experience of trying to push for the integration of that language and be directly level of patronization, saying that this is not real international law and this is not convincing enough. It's as if all of these really hard worked realities and experiences that States of the Global South sought to translate and experience that were later put down by political works were invaluable.
Taking this critique seriously, how would it be possible to shift this narrative?
Well, Foucault tells us that a situation of war and is a situation of extremity that lays power relations bare. And even though, honestly, I never wanted to become an international scholar specialized in Palestine, but I can't help but say that Palestine has become a vocal point of the critique of international law. And when people back home ask me what is international law doing for Palestine, I say, what is Palestine doing to international law? Because critique that was marginalized, that is, that you would just add on to your module in the last bit of this is how these some people talk about it, has become at the forefront of discussion because it has shown us exactly, is this discipline even relevant? If in the face of over 6 months of genocide, we look at the Second World War and we're like, we have all of these lessons learned. Of course, we rarely look at colonization and ask what are lessons learned. And this is what I'm kind of going at. But at the same time, these were not televised. These were not on social media. So now we have it in our faces, but yet the structure is sewn in such a way that it has placed people in pure helplessness in the face of political discourse. And we can't deny that our discipline through lawfare has facilitated this weird, I'm calling this actually hyper reality of genocide, where we're all just observing it. And it's very alienating as a scholar who comes from that context to see colleagues who are willing to debate the nitty-witty details of the law and debate on how much suffering is acceptable or not. And it's quite magical that there is a cognitive veil that doesn't allow us to see what we are talking about now. And in reaction to this, I've actually started to start all of my talks and speeches first with a recognition of the human suffering of which we speak. Because us as international lawyers and lawyers in general are taught to evade any level of emotion and do that. And of course, I need a more sophisticated thesis to put forth an argument for the importance of emotion, but we can't deny the importance of recognizing the reality of which we speak. We're not talking about numbers or rules or whatever. We are talking about something that is beyond bloody. So perhaps in answering your question, a shift, a way forward, I think if we are to recognize this moment, if this moment is to mean anything, it needs to be a moment that is a shift in the narrative. And I don't think it's only Palestine. I think that generally the political ethos of the world is changing. We're going from a unipolar world to perhaps a multipolar world. No one is to say this is better or worse, but historically speaking, having a multipolar world allows us to escape the world order, world-making dynamics of only one liberal narrative. Now you have multiple competing narratives that could possibly allow for a breather. That, we could say, is a little bit of the political context of the 1960s and 70s. And what we are aspiring or hoping is that the political context is apt for a similar revival. And a revival of breathing spaces that allow for this contestation of the normalization. So if anything, now we can see very clearly how violent is this normalization in the international legal community. When a genocide happens and 70% of the community just opt out of discussing it or even don't have a realization of perhaps we need to actually talk about this with people who've lived it. And of course, this is an issue that's deeply embedded with imperialism, colonialism. It is an international issue in general. And reaching a break, so Palestine has facilitated this shift, but the shift is already happening when we're allowing more spaces to contest such normalization. And how is that going forward? There is multiple discussions that are currently happening. One of which is to, first of all, discursively use the language of the 1960s and 70s, since we already have a base that is already there, and to open up these folders. How is it that we can get back that language that tried and sought to assert the agency of subjects that fall outside of the periphery of the world order? How is it that we can translate those experiences into the language of international law? One. And two, after that, is to then seriously push towards an integration of the experiences of the people affected by these realities, and to put to the forefront, again, everything that we've learned about transitional justice, the process of hearing and the process of validation, but then to put that into actual reparations. And I think one of the biggest, if there is a project that I would start with in international law and fixing it, it would be taking reparations seriously. That would be its title. Because the economic dimension of neo-colonial tactics is something, is a blind spot, is a man-made, politically engraved, blind aspect of international legal, public international law. The economic is not something of which we speak, but the neo-colonial is premised on the economic. So I would start there. And the formulation that I usually use here is perhaps going back to the question of justice, in the sense of saying that international law premises its legitimacy on some claim to justice. So I always say, and I tell my students, international law is like this very insecure guy that comes to you and says, I'm very cool and you should like me because I have these really lovely ideals like justice. But then he's very insecure because he knows that it takes a few years into studying international law. We dare not say the word justice among ourselves. And inevitably, at the end of the day, power has a much bigger role to play. So at that meeting between the claim to justice and the reality of international legal practice lies international law's biggest insecurities. What needs to happen is more collective knowledge and more challenging of this specific juncture to undo to put to the stage the insecurities of international law, and from there start to engage with a conversation where things are called by their name and where a recognition of reality happens. And the reality of which I speak of now is a reality of a deeply embedded domination. Even if we no longer live in colonization, the more I teach it, the more I learn it, the more I find out that we still live in the same dynamics.
Since the order of provisional measures on the 26th of January, the humanitarian situation in Gaza deteriorated considerably. And so on the 28th of March, in response to a further request for provisional measures by South Africa, the International Court of Justice provided a new order. Dr. Panzaudi kindly came back to discuss the context of these orders and what they stated.
Palestinians in Gaza are not only facing a risk of famine, but the court said famine is setting in. So the risk actually materialized. And this exceptionally grave development, as the court put it, constitutes a change in the situation that warrant the indication of new provisional measures. And this time, the measures that the court indicated are a little more specific than the first time around. The first measure that was indicated is for Israel to take measures to ensure, so not just enable, but ensure the provision of humanitarian aid to the population in Gaza. And they have to make sure that this happens. Then the court provides a non-exhaustive list of items that must reach the civilian population. These include food, water, electricity, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene, sanitation requirement, as well as medical supplies and medical care. The court also said that Israel has to increase the capacity of land crossing points and maintain them open for as long as necessary. So this is very important, I think. And Israel has to cooperate with the UN, read in between the lines, UNRWA. And again, I think this is significant, particularly in light of the accusation that UNRWA had been infiltrated by Hamas, which led some states to defund UNRWA itself. The second measure is for Israel to ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit acts which constitute a violation of any of the rights of the Palestinians in Gaza as a protected group under the Genocide Convention, including by preventing the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian assistance. This is a slightly convoluted provisional measure, I think, which again doesn't go as far as to order the suspension of Israel's military operation. But this time, we can affirm with certainty that it's implicit in the order. Why do I say that? If we look at the court's reasoning, the court simply noted statements by relief organizations, the ICRC, that the catastrophic humanitarian situation can only be addressed if military operations are suspended, but it's kind of relaying others' opinions. It did shy away, I think, from ordering Israel to suspend its military operations, reasoning that the court's order could not bind entities of those states that are not a party to the proceedings. But the separate opinions, I think, are significant because they give us a bit more insights as to what was actually going on within the court. And this time, there are seven judges that, in their separate opinions, stated that the court should have directly and explicitly ordered a ceasefire or the suspension of military operations, or that the only way to comply with the order is for Israel to suspend military operations. And this is why I say that it's actually implicit in the court's order already. Yusuf, in particular, Judge Yusuf, explains that already the provisional measure order dated the 26th of January is tantamount to an injunction to bring to an end any military operation that may contribute to the commission of genocidal acts, because the only effective way for Israel to meet its obligations is to suspend its military operations with immediate effect. So what many have been saying about the 26th January provisional measures order now, I think, is actually confirmed by the judges writing separately.
One may want to consider, however, whether the existence of these separate opinions provided for by the judges means anything for the case going forward, especially looking at the merit stage.
I think it does. And in particular, it's interesting to look at Judge Nolte's separate opinion. In January, he wrote, basically, I'm simplifying, that he was not persuaded that Israel's military operations as a whole were genocidal. He voted with the majority, but the strongest part of the case for him was about incitement to commit genocide and failure to prevent genocide. In the most recent decision, Judge Nolte wrote that Israel's starvation of Gaza's civilian population places the rights of the Palestinian people under the Genocide Convention at risk. What it means, in my view, is that the destruction of the group, so genocide, is not just a byproduct of the military operations, but it is Israel's strategy. Israel is using starvation as a weapon. This isn't a starvation caused by a natural disaster, a flood, or a drought. It is completely man-made. And I think this signals a big shift in the judge's position, which might in turn reflect like a much broader shift within the court. And I think this is important for South Africa's case and the way we'll be able to litigate the case on the merits.
As already mentioned, it'll be some time until the court arrives at its decision on the merits of this case. No doubt, there are also many more international legal issues to consider here, like international humanitarian law, the powers of the United Nations Security Council, or the potential recognition of Palestine as a member to the UN, to provide but a few examples. For now, a big thank you to all our guests for joining us and sharing their knowledge and insights on this episode, and of course you, the listener. As always, if there is a specific international legal issue, concept, or case that you would like us to cover, please write to us at jurisdictions@asa.nl. In the meantime, let us hope that we see an end to this dire situation and the ongoing human suffering at the heart of this case.